Today's guest says that by choosing to go with the flow, with the belief that by so doing life will be peaceful and fulfilling, is the wrong way to achieve happiness. Hello, everyone. My name is Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk. I'm very pleased to introduce to you Atherton Drenth, who is the author of Intuitive Dance. Atherton, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you very much. It's an honor.
Now, Atherton, you are described as a certified medical, intuitive, and holistic energy practitioner. What does that mean?
Well, what it means is that, first of all, I'm a clairvoyant, so I can see and feel people's energy fields, and I've been trained to find out where the blocks are in a person's field, because we know that if you get blocks in your energy field, you can have problems physically, mentally, emotionally, or spiritually. So my job is to go in and find out where the blocks are and then help that person to release them so that they can find their way back to wellness. Being a medical intuitive means that I have been trained on how to track the body and to keep my ego out of the way and listen to what the body has to say.
Now, you described yourself as a clairvoyant, and, you know, a lot of people sort of hear that word and go, yeah, right. And then there are just as many people who hear that and are really fascinated and curious about what exactly it means to be a clairvoyant.
Well, a clairvoyance is a particular type of intuitive ability, which means that I can see things clearly in my mind's eye, like pictures or movies. There are four different types of intuition. There's the clairvoyance, there's the clairaudient, which is clear hearing, there's the clairsentience, which is clear feeling, and then the last one is claircognizance, which is clear knowingness. We all have all four intuitive abilities, but everybody will have one that's more dominant than the other, and my dominant intuitive ability is being a clairvoyant.
So it's interesting. You're saying that everyone has the ability to sort of sense things in varying different ways.
Yes.
For those listening who are like, wait a minute, I don't have, what is she talking about? What are you talking about?
Well, everybody has had an instance in their life where they just know something, and they will make comments like, oh, I don't know where that came from, but I just knew that that was the right thing to say or do. Everybody has had an instance in their life where they have received a warning. They've received a prophetic dream cautioning them about something that's going to happen. Mothers, in particular, are very strongly intuitive without acknowledging it. Any woman that is a parent will tell you that they always get a sense of when their kids are up to something they shouldn't be. Men are very good at just knowing where they need to be, finding directions. These are all different examples of what it means to be intuitive. And everybody's doing it every day, but because we haven't labeled it, because we haven't identified it, people don't know what to call it. I mean, I went through the same thing. I didn't know that what I did had a name to it. I didn't know that I could hone it. I didn't know that there were different ways of using it. So it all came as a big surprise to me as well.
Were you frightened? Were you curious? Were you puzzled as you became more aware of your own skills?
No, I think I was relieved that I could actually do something with what I just always knew. I used to call it. I just always knew it was going to help me. I always knew that it was going to have the answer. I grew up in a home where my abilities to see things was encouraged. So I was very fortunate in that regard. But again, we never had a name for it. My parents never labeled it. And it wasn't until I was undergoing a major job restructuring through a company, and all the employees were taken through a training course to help them to identify their skill sets so that they could go out into other jobs, because we were all being laid off. And that's when the trainer came to me and said, "Do you realize how intuitive you are?" And I just remember looking at him and thinking, wow, you mean there's a name for this? That's cool.
Interesting. So it was really, as you said, it was a relief to know what was actually going on. I'd like to hear a little bit more about your backstory. You, at one point, pursued a career as a medical technologist. Tell us a little bit about that part of your life.
Well, I was... I trained to be a medical technologist, and I worked in a private lab in hospitals for about 12 years. Then the medical care system here in Canada was undergoing some major changes, and we were told that 50% of all medical technologists were going to be unemployed within the next 10 years, and this was going back into the 80s and the 90s, because of automation. You know, they were bringing in equipment that was doing what we did manually in two-thirds less the time. So I was very fortunate in the fact that I worked for a company that said, you know, we've got a lot of very highly trained specialists here, and they have a particular skill set, but because they have been trained to do just one job, we need to help them to find, to identify what their advanced skill set is so that they can go back out into the marketplace and use those skills. So I was identified as being highly intuitive, but I was also identified as being a good management material, and I was a strong organizer. I eventually got a job working as a manager, and I would go in and be a problem solver for doctor's practices. So I would go in on contract and help them to reorganize their offices and get staff on track and get them properly trained. That eventually led to my going back to school to become more formally trained in office management. And that landed me in a corporate job working for a crop insurance company, of all things, where I was in charge of training and rewriting all their training manuals. And it was through that experience that I eventually collapsed and woke up one day and had a near-death experience, which led me to becoming a healer and medical intuitive.
Now, I also note that part of your history is a medical misdiagnosis. What was going on?
Well, I had suffered from years with crippling migraines, losing weight, severe insomnia. I couldn't go to the bathroom. And I had struggled with that for close to 20 years. I'd seen every doctor imaginable, had every test imaginable. And I got everything from there's nothing wrong with you, it's all in your head, to you have MS. And nothing made sense. And you reach a point where you just start to give up. And I started going into more alternative health care, chiropractic, getting some Reiki. And it was helping me, but it wasn't solving what the problem was. And then I had this near-death experience, and I woke up one day to finding an angel standing beside my bed, because by this time I'd gone from having maybe, if I was lucky, 2 hours of sleep a day to sleeping 22 to 24 hours a day.
Oh my.
And I was down to 98 pounds. I was having difficulty walking. I couldn't sit up for any length of time. I couldn't eat. And when I was given this choice by this angel, she said, you can live or you can die. At first I chose death because I was tired. There was nothing more that we could do. I mean, no stone had been left unturned. Everybody told me there was nothing wrong with me, and yet I was wasting away. And at first I just said, fine, take me. I've had enough. I can't do this anymore. And as I started to leave my body and feel this incredible, supreme bliss and divine love, it was just such a relief. And then all of a sudden I realized that I was leaving my husband to raise two teenagers on his own. Mm. And I couldn't do that. I didn't think it was playing fair. So I asked if I could come back. And I heard this chuckle, and next thing I knew, I woke up the next morning, and all of a sudden I could sit up and I could start walking again. Within a two-week period, I had some very interesting synchronicitous events happen that led me to see a young man by the name of Larry Steele. And when I saw him for the first time, I thought, oh, you have got to be kidding me. I had never seen energy work before. I had never seen anybody undergo a treatment. And the first time you see it, you think this is so far out in left field that this can't possibly be of any service to anyone. And yet, the minute he touched me, I knew that he knew things about me. And he looked at me and he said, oh, you have you're a celiac. And I just looked at him and I was stunned because I didn't tell him anything. All I told him is that I had migraines and I suffered from insomnia. And so I went back to the doctors and they did a biopsy 3 days later and confirmed it. And it was the worst case of undiagnosed celiac disease that they had ever seen. And I was lucky to be alive.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah.
There are a couple of phrases, terms that you use that we hear a lot about today, and I'm not sure that folks exactly know what they mean. So first, let me ask you about Reiki healing. What exactly is Reiki healing?
Well, I'm not trained in Reiki, but Reiki is a method of going in and channeling healing energy into the body. That's my understanding of it. Reiki's been around for a long time, and there are a lot of healers are trained in Reiki. Reiki, I am not. So that's about as much as I can give you because I'm not an expert. I'm not a practicer of Reiki.
Okay, that's fair. And energy healing?
Energy healing is, again, going in and looking at the energy field as a whole. So we work with the body physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. We're looking at the whole package, and we're finding out where the blocks are. Because the body is very wise and knows exactly what it needs. It just needs help being heard. And my job is to go in and listen to where those blocks are. And then we do what's called tracking, which means we say, okay, so we have a block in the liver. Let's find out what's the story in the liver. And then we start to take a look that maybe there's been a trauma. Maybe there has been a particular emotional event or there has been an illness that has happened. And the body just needs help overcoming that obstacle.
You just mentioned the word obstacle, and you talk about the need to change negative belief systems. Why?
Well, everything's made out of energy. Einstein uncovered that with his formula, E equals mc squared, and things can exist in matter and energy at exactly the same time. So we can have a physical body, but we also have an energy body. We know the energy body exists because we can take pictures of it now. The Russians have done the most extensive research with regards to that, and they now have an instrument called the GDV that they use as a medical instrument in their hospitals, and it's being studied in about 20 different countries. So eventually I figure in North America we'll get with the program. In the meantime, people such as myself are able to go in and find those blockages without that medical equipment. So we find that our thoughts, which are energy, also can solidify into matter. So if you believe that nothing is possible, then that's exactly what happens in your life, because the universe always mirrors back what you believe. So if you have this belief system, for example, that nothing is ever going to go right, then the universe is always going to prove that to you. But if you change your mind, if you give yourself permission to choose differently and see everything in your life as going smoothly and beautifully, then that's exactly what's going to happen to you.
You know, that kind of a shift, which, you know, is so critical for people to be able to go from the what I can't to what I can do. But for so many people, that's such a difficult, for all kinds of reasons, that's such a difficult bridge to cross, if you will. Do you find in working with your clients, because I understand you have a fairly robust practice yourself, what's the process of crossing that bridge? Does someone have to be ready to shift that kind of thinking? What actually happens?
That's a good question. The people that I see are usually the people that have fallen through the cracks. Like myself, they've tried everything. No stone's been left unturned, and they're just at that point where there's no other place to go. You've hit rock bottom. And when you find that sometimes it's the result is something that's happened to you in your past, and because of a decision that your ego mind has made and that you can change it, first of all, you're so shocked it can be that easy. And then you get angry, and then you get curious, and then you get determined. And then people come back to me and they say, I wish I had known it had been this easy. And is it tricky? Yes. I mean, try changing a habit, right?
Exactly.
And it just takes determination. It takes will, and it takes a conscious effort to realize that you can choose differently. Now, our ego, on the other hand, is just a great big tape recorder. And that message is always going to be there. And this is what really messes people up. You know, they figure that if I do a positive affirmation and it changes my life, every time that message comes up, their first response is, oh, it's not working, and they give up, which is not the right thing to do. they need to understand that the ego is just a tape recorder. And that message is always going to be there, and it's always going to crop up. They just need to retrain it with a new message. So, for example, if you've got a child who's 3 years old, and she got stuck with her hand in the cookie jar, and her mother comes rushing in and slaps her hand and says, "Don't eat the cookie," the ego is going to record that message as, "Don't eat the cookie." So then as she gets older, every time she wants to have a cookie, her ego mind is going to press that little play button and go, "Don't eat the cookie." And then she's going to feel guilty. And then she's going to feel upset. And then she's going to want to eat even more cookies because that message just keeps playing over and over again. Well, when she's in her 40s and she's trying to lose weight and she's addicted to cookies, all she's got to do is go back and realize that the 3-year-old recorded this message of, "Don't eat the cookie." Well, now she can go back into that aspect of herself and say, "No, you were being punished for eating a cookie because you hadn't eaten your supper. You've eaten your supper. You're taking care of yourself. It's all right to have a cookie. You don't need a 12. You can have a cookie. Good girl. Good girl."
And that can be such a huge shift in the internal as well as the external awareness for that individual.
Yes. Because when you start dealing with those negative messages like that, what you are in essence doing at an esoteric level is you are forcing yourself to become more conscious of your unconscious, which puts you in a stronger position of choice.
You talk about the ego as being a tape recorder.
Mm-hmm.
Say more about that.
Well, you know, the ego is one of those things that's very elusive. We all have one. I know that in the beginning, when I started to realize what ego messages I was dealing with, it made me quite angry. And I thought, well, then I need to find a way to destroy the ego and become ego-less. Hmm. And that's always an interesting journey when you try to do that one. And then I started to realize that I needed my ego because my ego was an important part of who I was. But it wasn't in charge. My soul was in charge. My higher self was in charge. My conscious mind was in charge. And that my ego was just a great big tape recorder that was just the inner child who didn't know any better, who recorded these messages without any emotional context. It didn't have the story. It just had the belief. And that led me to understanding that sometimes what we believe isn't the truth. And if we can give ourselves permission to find the truth now in consciousness, it changes everything. So your ego is something that we can work with, and it can be managed. It just doesn't have to be the dictator in the room.
So in fact, it sounds like what you're saying is that the ego is kind of like a computer. It takes in information without discrimination.
Yes.
I don't know that a computer is actually the right analogy.
Yeah, it's kind of tricky because you look at it from this point of view. You can have identical twins playing in a sandbox, and they're both playing with an exact identical toy truck. And somebody walks over and leans over the sandbox and simultaneously takes both trucks away from them at exactly the same time. One twin is going to go, "Oh, okay," and pick up another toy and get on with the rest of their life. No biggie. The other could be traumatized. "You can't trust strangers. People take things away from you. I'm unhappy." You have no control over how each person chooses to respond to an event. So it can be the simplest event in the world, and people just think nothing of it, whereas the other person, it can become very traumatic.
The idea that different people have different experience of potentially the exact same moment, and mm-hmm. that it can be vastly, vastly different. You know, for many folks, they will say, "Well, I was there and I didn't have that experience, so what's the matter with you?" And I think what you're saying, and certainly what is very true and healthy, is that people have the experiences they have. And so
yes.
rather than trying to rewrite it in your view, be open to what others' views are and start
yes.
from that place.
Exactly, because as we have all hear all the time, is you don't know that person's story. You don't know their history. You don't know what they've been through. And until you've walked in their shoes, you have no concept of why they react the way they do.
Atherton, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue. And I'd like to pick up with energy tyrants, what they are and what we need to do about them. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk, and I'm having a conversation with Atherton Drenth, who is the author of The Intuitive Dance, Building, Protecting, and Clearing Your Energy. We'll be right back. Atherton, what are energy tyrants?
Energy tyrants are people who are very insecure and have incredibly low self-esteem. And what they do is they work very hard at trying to boost themselves up, and the way they do that is by putting the other person down. So there are different types of energy tyrants. There's the emotional enabler. They're always looking for constant approval and reassurance. You have to make them always boost them up and make them feel better about themselves. There's the poor me energy tyrant. They're the victim. Nothing is ever their fault. Oh, poor me. Look what's happened to me. I need you to feel sorry for me. The next one is a drama critic, and they just live from one crisis to another. Everything is a huge deal. Everything is a big deal. Oh, you would never believe what happened to me last night. The next one is called Ergo, and they're egomaniacs. They are very black and white. It's my way or the highway. They're cynical. They're arrogant. They're sarcastic. They're condescending. The next is the chatterbox. They just never shut up. I mean, they're just constantly talking. You can't get a word in edgewise. There's the judge. They're critical of everything and everyone. They're very quick to point out other people's faults. The envier is another type. They're extremely jealous. They always make you feel inferior. They're your best friend one day and your number one enemy the next. And then you have the Klingons, which just suck you dry. They follow you around like little lost puppies. They can't survive without you. They have to have you around all the time. They need to know where you are. They're constantly checking in. So when you start to understand that an energy tyrant is just somebody who has no self-worth and very low self-esteem, it's easier for you to understand and be more compassionate, but it also helps you to be more consciously aware of the fact that you choose to let them be involved in your life, and it's important that you start choosing to start to say no to that kind of behavior.
You know, what's interesting is even as you're going through the list of different types of energy tyrants, I'm automatically connecting it to a potential diagnostic category. And
yeah,
it strikes me that to think about someone as a Klingon, for example, versus somebody who is perhaps abusive, puts even you, the person who's having the experience with this energy tyrant, in a different place.
Yes.
It gives you, I think, a different kind of energy around understanding and around dealing with this kind of a person.
Yes, I would agree. Yes.
So let's talk about, for example, the person who is the drama critic. Everything is a crisis. And, mm-hmm. You know, I sort of laughed as you said that because I think we all know at least one of those.
Yes.
And in fact, certainly in terms of the news and media, those folks get the most coverage and they're very popular. So they, for good or for ill, serve something of a purpose, at least in how we think about our social worlds.
Yes. Well,
tell us more about the drama critic who's going from crisis to crisis. If you've got somebody like that in your life, you love them, you care about them, you don't want them to go from crisis to crisis, but if you're thinking about them as an energy tyrant, are you kind of stuck? I mean, what do you do with that?
I agree. It's very difficult because now you're getting into how do you create strong emotional boundaries while still being in a loving, compassionate place. And you're right. We all have that one person in our life that behaves that way and you love them, but it doesn't mean you have to buy into it, and it also doesn't mean that you have to feed it. So when I'm dealing with a drama critic, I stand there and I listen and I go, oh, really? And my classic response is, so what do you think you're going to do about it? And they don't like it when you do that.
Yeah.
Because what you're doing is you're listening to them, but then you're forcing them to make a decision. Well, I don't know what to do. Well, you know, when you figure that out, let me know. And if you need any help, I'll be happy to help you.
So
it shuts them down in a loving, compassionate way, in other words.
I hear that because I can just picture the drama critic going on and on, and you're saying, well, wow, what do you think you might do about that? And them all of a sudden sort of being pulled up short because they're not used to being asked that question.
Yes. Yes.
And then it might force them to look inside in a way that might well be troubling for them. I mean, they're a drama critic for a reason.
Exactly.
So as you think about these different kinds of people in your lives, what if you've got any one of these in your workplace? What if you have a supervisor who is envious of you? I mean, that's kind of a bit of a nightmare.
Yes, it is, and I have been in those situations, and they are incredibly tricky and difficult. And I learned through my training to stay present, to breathe, to send them love, and realize that there was nothing I could do to change it or to fix it. And all I could do was be myself. I often started looking for another job.
Okay. Because at some point, you have to know that they're doing whatever they're doing and they're not going to stop just because you have perhaps learned a way to deal with them, which is different from other people in the office.
Exactly. And you're in a no-win situation. And the more you try to fix it, it makes it worse. The more you pull back from it, it seems to just aggravate things. It's an impossible situation, and I found that the only way I could cope was just to breathe and to meditate and to ground.
If you feel as though you can't get another job, that you don't have that option, do you have any suggestions for how a person can deal with that themselves? Is there anything they can say or do for themselves?
Well, things that they could do is they could be cutting cords with them on a daily basis. That helps to remove a lot of the negative charge that's happening between your field and the next.
What does that mean, cutting cords?
Well, so because we're energy, fear sends out threads of energy. And it's like getting caught up in cat hair or tangled up in string. And we're all exposed to them every day. We send them out and we receive them. It's just the way life is because we all have those moments of fear. So what you can do is at night when you're by yourself, you can call in the Archangel Michael and you can ask to cut cords with everyone you've been in contact with on that day. And then what he does is he comes in and he cleans out all that fear energy. The other thing that you can do, and I explain this in more detail in my book, is you can do a particular cord cutting with that particular person. The other thing you can do is you can also ask for divine intervention. Whatever has happened between you and this person at any level and any lifetime, you ask for divine intervention in healing and love and light. And I have found that to be very effective as well, because what it does is it takes away the charge and it changes the circumstances. And so long as you remain in a calm, loving place and give them the space, you'll find that there'll be a shift, because they won't be so easily threatened. Whatever's happened between the two of you energetically is suddenly being taken away.
So even if you feel like you're stuck, you're not stuck.
Yes.
Okay, which I think is very empowering.
Yes.
You talked about grounding. Why is grounding? We hear, again, it's another term that we hear very often. What does it mean to be grounded, and why is it important to be grounded?
Well, it's interesting you should bring that up, because I was very confused about what it meant to be grounded in the beginning as well. And being grounded means that you're calm, you're present, and you're unflappable. You can think clearly and rationally even in a crisis. It gives you clarity. It helps you to stand back and realize, oh, that person has an issue. It's not my issue. So I'm a big proponent of grounding. I teach a technique called the vertical axis, which helps to ground you both into heaven and earth at the same time. It was one of the very first things that I learned how to do when I was training in the healing arts, and I found it to be such a profound game changer for me, because it really calmed me down. I was reduced my anxiety a great deal. It helped me to be calmer, more present. I found that I was able to more clearly identify when people were trying to get me hooked up into their own personal agendas, and I could be clearer about my own emotional boundaries and step back from that. I didn't get caught up in people's drama as quickly or as easily anymore. I was sleeping better. And I found that I was thinking more rationally and coming up with better decisions for myself and my family.
Is that a technique that you can share with us now?
Sure. So the vertical axis technique is very simple and easy to do. And whether you imagine or pretend it, what you do is you imagine or pretend there is a root coming down from your tailbone, going deep into the earth. Feel it going deep down into the earth and spreading out for miles and miles and miles. And then you ask for permission to be connected to the intelligence of nature. You feel that energy coming up through that root, and it's like energy through, like water through a straw. You feel that energy being pulled up through your body, right up through your feet, your legs, in your entire body. You're running it up through your body to the top of your head. You feel the top of your head opening up, and then you feel that energy from the intelligence of nature washing over you like water in a fountain. Then you imagine that you are inside your head and you're looking up towards the heaven, and you ask to be connected to spiritual intelligence. You'll see a beam of light coming down from the heavens, and it feels very warm like sunlight. You feel that running down through your body, again, into every cell of your being and down through your root. Then you see yourself coming into your heart and see those two energies coming together. And that's when you form the vertical axis. Because when the energy from the intelligence of nature and spiritual intelligence come together, you feel the love of the divine and you feel the love of the divine Mother Earth. And then you send that energy of the loving divine out into every part of your body. You open up your heart and send it out into your energy field. You send it out to your family, your workplace, and then out into the world. And what that is doing is that's helping you to be consciously aware that not only are you one with the divine, but you are one with everybody on the planet. And then you're sending that loving wisdom out into the planet. And Lord knows we need that more than anything now.
That is very true. Is this an exercise that you would recommend people do on a daily basis?
I tell people to do it every single day. Every one of my clients gets taught how to do the vertical axis, and they all love it. I do it twice a day. I do it every morning, and I do it every night before I go to bed.
And just for those listening who are driving in their cars, this is not the thing to do while you're driving, but it is something to do when you're in a physically secure, safe environment.
Exactly.
You talk about emotional blackmail.
Yes.
What is that?
Emotional blackmail is a very subtle form of a verbal abuse that's insidious, pervasive, and life-destroying. I think it is one of the most damaging forms of emotional abuse that we have, as human beings, have ever come up with. It renders you powerless and ineffective. It makes you doubt everything about yourself, even though you're standing in truth. You know, it's like standing there and wearing a red coat and having somebody walk up to you and say, that coat isn't red, it's blue. And you're looking at your red coat and saying, no, this is a red coat. No, it's not. It's blue. What's wrong with you? Can't you see that?
So it sounds a bit like gaslighting.
Yes, it's gaslighting.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different way to talk about gaslighting. And gaslighting, I would say, would be a subset of emotional blackmail.
Okay.
Emotional blackmail can be at a personal level. It can be at a family level. It can be a tribal level. It can be statements like, what, you don't love us anymore? Or who do you think you are, smarty pants? Or you're getting too big for your britches, Missy? Or so now you think you're smarter than us? Or so you're the only person who can do anything right? See how disempowering those statements are?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think about the political environment that often occurs. In which someone might say, take away your ability to perform a particular function and then blame you for not having performed that function. Is that the same thing?
Yep.
Okay.
Exactly.
So we really need to be mindful of that and do a lot of work to avoid it, to work through it. How do we, I mean, I just think as a species, we're all kind of really good at that.
Well, I think that the easiest way to deal with emotional blackmail is, when it's thrown at you, is to stand back and realize that they're really only talking about themselves.
Okay.
So if someone says to me, oh, so now you're smarter than us, that what they're really saying is, oh, I'm afraid that you feel everybody's smarter than me. You flip it around. Because people who engage in gaslighting or emotional blackmail really have no self-esteem, and they will do anything to make themselves feel better, and they will take anybody down with them in order to feel better about themselves. So really, they need a lot of compassion, they need a lot of sympathy, but you also have to be strong enough to be determined not to engage, which again I think is that conscious journey. Okay, so you're saying this and you're behaving this way, is this somebody I really want to be involved with? Is this something that I really need to buy into? Can I give myself permission to leave this? You know, when you look at gangs, gangs are very, very heavily engaged in emotional blackmail. And it's very, very difficult for people to leave a gang, for example. But those who do are the ones that say, you know what, I just stopped buying into it. And it was scary and it was hard, but I just realized that I didn't need to believe them anymore. And I find the same thing when I'm helping women leave abusive relationships,
mm-hmm.
that all of a sudden they have that moment of clarity of, this is not my problem. I didn't create this. This is nothing I can fix. This is damaging my life. This is infecting my children. And I need to do whatever I need to do to get out.
And it is a tremendous shift when you make the decision to pull yourself away from an abusive relationship. It's also a time when you need to be really mindful of your physical safety as well as your emotional safety. So there's lots of work that you need to do when you're making that, quite frankly, life-saving choice to leave.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
You talk about the practice of using intuition from a ethical perspective, and I was struck by that. I ethics is another one of those things that, you know, you tend to attach to a particular professional field, if you will, but not so much to the use of intuition. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I found when you become aware of your intuition, you know things without knowing why you know things. And it's very easy for you to just start using your intuition all over the place. So, for example, me as a mother, when I was really giving myself permission to be aware of my intuition, and if one of my children was having a problem, intuitively, I could come up with 10 different solutions, which I was quite happy to share with them without being asked. And they would be upset with me. And I couldn't understand why they would be upset with me. I mean, you have a problem, I have a solution. Why don't you just do it?
Right.
And we all run into that. You know, we have a friend who calls us up and they're having a problem, and we have the solution and we are happy to share because we love them. They're our friend. This is what we're supposed to do. This is my role as a friend, is it not? But we don't realize that the friend hasn't asked us to solve the problem. So I developed these intuitive ethics to help me to understand when to use it and how to use it. Because in the healing arts, we are trained over and over again that we have to honor and respect each person's journey. We've all been given free choice, free will, which means we have choice. And we can't choose or judge how another person chooses or decides how to solve a problem.
Atherton, I'm going to interrupt you. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to continue along this path of ethics and intuition. So don't go away, folks. We'll be back in just a moment. Atherton, I had to chuckle as you were talking about the experience of being a parent, and you've got all the answers that you're very willing to share, and your child or your children's like, no, wait, not interested. And it really is chuckle, because how many times have we all felt that way, whether it's about a child or a friend or a colleague or a neighbor, and how many times have we heard that? If you would just listen to me, fill in the blanks.
Yes, exactly.
But what you're saying is that it really is a matter of ethical practice to wait until you're asked.
Yes.
What if you're not asked?
So I came up with what I call the intuitive ethics. And the first one is just because you know doesn't mean you do. The next is wait to be asked. The third is only do as asked. If you're not asked but wish to help, send them love silently. Always ask, is this mine or does it belong to someone else? And then be honest. So I'll just go through each of them so people understand.
Great.
So just because you know doesn't mean you do. So your friend calls you up and they have a problem and your intuition kicks in and you've got 10 different solutions. That doesn't give you the right to share. Your friend has called you up. She needs someone to talk to. She's asking you to listen. So how you respond to that is what I say is, are you asking me for advice or do you just need me to listen? And that always makes people stand back. And I can't tell you how many times they said, no, I just want you to listen. Well, then you just sit there and you bite your tongue because you haven't been asked for your advice. They just want somebody to hear them out. They're thinking out loud. That's fine. That's honor. That's compassion. That's listening. So then I wait to be asked. If they say, no, I would really like to know what you think, then what I would do is I would share my opinion, but I would give them choices. Well, in my opinion, I think you could do either A, B, or C. What do you think you should do? I hand it back. Because now you are showing that you are listening, but now you are honoring their choice and their free will by giving them some suggestions. If they say to you, no, I just want you to listen. Only do as asked. So if they ask you to help them, then again, only do what they've asked you to help them with. Don't use that as a door that you can walk through and say, oh, well, then I'll just do all of this. Okay? So just because I've been asked to come and look after my grandson doesn't mean I have the right to go home and clean my daughter's house.
Gotcha.
Okay?
Okay.
That's just a simple example.
Okay.
The next is, if you're not asked to help, but you can see how tragic the situation is, they don't want your help, they don't want your opinion, then all you can do is just sit there and say, I love you, over and over again, because it does shift people's energy field. The other thing I find is that asking, is it mine or does it belong to someone else? A lot of people react by feeling their emotions so intensely that they start to react too. So your friend calls you up, she's going through a crisis, she's crying on the phone, and all of a sudden you can feel it in your body and you're starting to feel sick to your stomach and get a headache and you're nauseated. That's when you have to ask yourself, are you just that empathetic that you're feeling everything that she's feeling, or is this really yours? And if it's theirs, all you have to do is go, yep, this is hers, it's not mine. And then your body can calm down and you can go back to that rational thinking. And next is to be honest. We don't do enough honesty. And I think especially as parents, we do our children a huge disservice by not being honest. And I talk about an instance where my husband and I were having a rather tense argument early one morning, and our son, who was 3 at the time, walked into the kitchen and, you know, grabbed onto my house coat and pulled on it, and he looked at me and he says, Mommy, are you and Daddy having an argument? Well, first of all, I was stunned the kid knew the word. And I stood there and I looked at him and I thought, yeah, this is a moment of truth. Because if I say to him, no, 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 everything's fine, there's a huge chance he's going to think it's his fault. Because he has no idea what's going on here. His little ego just knows that there's an argument going on. And he couldn't make it all about him. And I looked at him and I said, no, Mommy and Daddy are not happy with each other right now. It has nothing to do with you. Why don't you go and play? He went, oh, okay, and off he went. And so often our children come to us and say, are you feeling all right? And we'll say, no, no, we're fine, because we think we're doing the right thing by protecting them. No, we're not. We're denying their intuition, and we just lied to them. And now they're going to make up a story. They're going to make an assumption. Oh, I must have done something wrong because she's not telling me the truth. When it's so much easier just to say, you know, I had a really rough day at work, and it has nothing to do with you. How about a hug? Why don't you go do your homework, and I'll work it out. You know?
And it also gives the child permission to access the full range of not only his or her awareness, but their feelings as well.
Exactly. And you're creating a clear boundary. This is my problem, not yours. Thank you for asking. Give me a hug. You get on with the rest of your life, and I will go and deal with this. So now I'm not making you fix me. I'm not making you feel guilty because I haven't told you the truth.
Right? And it also, I would think, would build trust, too, because you have told the truth.
Exactly. You know, and we tell our children, don't you lie to me. If you lie to me once, then that's it, we're done. But parents lie to their kids all the time. Oh, I'm fine. Don't worry about it. It's not your problem. Oh, never mind. Don't worry about it. Well, that's just a different kind of lying.
Well, that's true. So you don't need to bring your child into your life to fix it or to be your buddy, which unfortunately a lot of parents do, particularly mm-hmm. in divorces or separations. There are some parents who will turn the child into their best buddy, which is certainly not good at all. But you're saying tell the truth with limits.
Yep.
And limit setting is often very difficult for folks.
Yeah, they don't need to know all the gory details. They just need to know that it's not their problem, you know. And sometimes it's as simple as, you know, I've had a really rough day today, and if you could just go in and make your bed and throw a load of wash in the washing machine, it would go a long way to helping me not feeling so stressed out. Easy enough done, right?
Absolutely. Why is getting quality sleep an important conversation that you included in the intuitive dance?
Well, I think that we're such a stressed-out society that we have lost the importance of sleep. I always have to laugh when I read these articles about how to get more done on less sleep, for example.
Right.
like sleep is something that is an obstacle that needs to be overcome, totally ignoring the fact that God created sleep for a reason. I mean, it's our time of restoring and renewing and rebuilding and healing. And yet, on the other hand, if you're in a really stressful job, we have the medical professional in particular telling us, well, you should be getting at least 8 hours of sleep. Well, that's easy enough for you to say, but if I'm freaked out and stressed out and tossing and turning all night, that's not solving the problem. And we don't realize that a lot of the reasons why we can't sleep at night is because we are still stressed out and anxious, because our little ego voice is nattering away in the back of our minds telling us how we can't do anything right. But the other thing that happens is we go out into what we call the dream time, out into the astral plane, and we try to fix our problems all night. So we're working all day and we're working all night, and we wake up in the morning and we're even more exhausted than we were the day before. And there is a way to manage that, which I found really quite intriguing, because I was caught up in the same cycle. I had my practice grew very quickly. It was very unusual to have a practice grow that quickly. I was waking up every morning more and more exhausted. I was having to take longer periods of time off just to restore. And then one night I couldn't take it anymore, and I just asked for help. And I had this very vivid dream where I was shown that I was going out into the dream time and working with my clients all night. So it was no wonder I was exhausted in the morning. And, you know, as it was explained to me, that was not God's intent. We are supposed to rest. Well, what am I supposed to do about these stressful situations? Well, you can hand them over to the angels, and they will help you deal with it so that you can wake up in the morning fully rested, restored, and renewed. And we started teaching it to clients. You know, I started teaching it to my students, teaching it to clients, and they were coming back, and they're saying, I had my first decent night's sleep in 10 years. I know it made a dramatic improvement for me. And people who are trying to deal with a lot of stress and anxiety and panic attacks in their life have found it incredibly helpful. And it's so easy to do.
How do you do it?
So what I do is, after I've done my vertical axis, I call in the Archangel Michael, I cut cords with everybody, and then I say, when I enter into the dream time, I ask to be carried to the higher levels of spiritual intelligence and instruction, and that I ask that you work with me, my body physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually, so that I wake up in the morning fully rested, restored, and renewed. That's it.
And that allows you to drift into a peaceful sleep?
Yep. And then you're actually resting so that you can actually deal with your issues the next day in a more conscious environment. You see, when we dream, we travel out into the astral plane. And there's two aspects to the astral plane. There's the lower astral plane and there's the upper astral plane. And most of us have a bad habit of hanging out in the lower astral plane. And that's where all the funky stuff happens. That's where we have the nightmares, we have the weird dreams. You know, you've walked into a bar and you're having a beer with an elephant and a duck. It's where you're going to have your little mind arguments, or you're going to fight with somebody that you had an argument with earlier in the day. And that's not where we're supposed to hang out. You want to go into the higher levels of spiritual instruction, where you can be shown how to pre-dream your future, how to solve problems. You can hand things over to the angels. And then what that does is it gives your physical and energy body a chance to totally rest and renew.
You reference handing things over to the angels.
Mm-hmm.
What about the folks who were listening who were saying, angels, I don't believe in that?
Well, you don't have to believe in angels. I mean, they can hand it over to God. They can hand it over to Jesus. They can hand it over to Muhammad. You can hand it over to Buddha. The thing is that we have a higher spiritual intelligence. There's a higher spiritual consciousness that is there to help us. It's there to be of service. So whether you call it an angel, God, Jesus, or Muhammad, it doesn't matter. The point is that there's a higher source of love and consciousness that's there for you, that you can work with.
At the beginning of today's conversation, I raised the issue that going with the flow, and with the belief that things would just work out, was, in your view, the wrong way to achieve happiness? And as we've been talking today, it seems like what you're saying is that you can make a conscious decision to choose whatever path you choose, which is more intentional, it's more engaged, it's more involved than just, quote unquote, going with the flow. Am I understanding correctly?
Yes, I mean, that going with the flow is can be interpreted in so many different ways. Some people see it as sitting on a ship and they have no control over the sails or the rudder, and so they just have to take what life dishes out. We don't realize that we're sitting in a boat with our hand on the rudder, and we have control over whether the sails go up or down. So you can go with the flow, your hand on the rudder, sails up, and flowing along with the ups and downs of life in consciousness, realizing that you have choice and free will. You can choose to run your boat into the shore or hit a rock, or you can choose to steer around it. Or you can be totally unconscious and just sit in the boat and just pray that you don't get shipwrecked.
You have power and you can make choices.
Yes.
And I think that, well, let me ask you this. What is your wish for folks who engage with the intuitive dance? And I say engage because this is not a book that you just read. This is a book in which you engage, I would suggest, your whole self. So as listeners and readers engage, what do you want them to begin with? What do you want them to come away with?
What I hope they come away with is they realize that the greatest gift that God could give to them was free will. And with that came the ability to choose. And that means that they can choose to go through life easily, regardless of the ups and downs, or they can go through it hard. You know, we're all told that if we follow the rules, if we just go with the flow, life will be peaceful and fulfilling. But, you know, again, I think we have it all wrong. We have more control over the stress and anxiety in our lives than we think we do. It isn't the outside events that are causing stress and anxiety. It's the way we react to the outside events that's creating stress and anxiety. And when we realize that we have a choice in how we manage all of that, then we can be more loving and compassionate human beings, and we can be more present. And then we start to realize that life isn't what happens to us. Life is what we choose to accept.
Atherton, I've really enjoyed our conversation today. Can you give us your website so folks can get more information?
Certainly. So it's www.athertontrence.ca, and that's spelled A-T-H-E-R-T-O-N-D-R-E-N-T-H.
And that's .ca?
Yes.
All right. Thank you so much for the book, but certainly thank you for spending the time with us today and for sharing your expertise.
Well, thank you very much. It's been an honor.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is available to you on demand by going to mindtalk.org. That's mindtalk.org. You can also download the Mind Talk app from the iTunes or the Google Play Store. Mind Talk is provided as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. I'd love to know where in the world you are as you're listening to Mind Talk, so please do send an email to me with that information, any questions, any comments, to Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. And again, that's mindtalk.org. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.